from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Discovering Eve and the Making of the Hebrew Bible, this week on Soundings. My guests are Carol Myers of Duke University, Kyle McCarter of the Johns Hopkins University, and Michael Fishbane of Brandeis University. Carol Myers, Kyle McCarter, and Michael Fishbane participated in a recent conference at the National Humanities Center on the Making of the Hebrew Bible. First on this edition of Soundings, a discussion with Carol Myers about her new book, Discovering Eve, Ancient Israelite Women in Context, published by Oxford University Press. Following that, a conversation with Michael Fishbane and Kyle McCarter about the history and composition of the Hebrew Bible. Here is Carol Myers.
The Eden story is a beginning story. Mm-hmm. And it's set at the beginning of the Hebrew Bible, which is for its most part based in historical reality. However, the beginning stories at the beginning of it do not necessarily speak to us in the same kind of way as the same genre as historically based literature does.
You mean putting it into a time period? When you say historically based, what have you got in mind?
Well, beginning, let's say, with the patriarchs.
All right.
The patriarchal narratives, whether they're not literally historically true in every detail, are based in a real-life experience. Mm-hmm. The stories before that, before Genesis 12, are, and I hate to use this word because it conjures up something that's false or phony or not true, but they're much more mythically oriented. They're stories of origins which are cast in the language of the human imagination in order to get across very profound points about what the ancient Israelites, the ancient Hebrews, believed about who they were, where they came from.
All right, well, who was Eve? An enormous question and a simple one and a complex one all at the same time.
I think Eve is a symbolic figure, as is Adam. Let's not leave him out of the picture,
right?
Either there were men in the ancient world as well. Eve and Adam are symbolic figures. I often use the word archetypal, mm-hmm, to describe or to represent them. That is, for the Hebrews, they represented the essence of male and female, the essence of people together. They're a pair, and I don't think we should forget that they're a pair. They together represent humanity.
Uh-huh.
I think that when most of us think about the Garden of Eden and think about the Eve and Adam story, that our conceptualizations are colored by the lenses of 2,000 years of post-biblical history.
Mm-hmm.
And we're just as apt to see it through the eyes of a Renaissance painter and through the words of Milton and Paradise Lost as we are through the biblical story itself.
Not to mention Madison Avenue today.
Right. I started to do some work on this problem or this subject some time ago, and I sat down and read the local morning paper, and no less than 3 references to the Eden story were present on that one morning.
Goodness.
And I might add that most of those, I think, were misconceptions or misappropriations of the story.
Well, what specifically did you take issue with when we talk about misconceptions today about Eve?
Eve has an image problem. She's associated with a number of what I call S words. Sin, sexuality. Sexuality is okay. Uh-huh. Sin, sexuality, subordination, submissiveness. And my contention is that those S words associated with Eve may not be, at least that's the way I approached the story to begin with, may not be present in its original setting, in its original context. And what I wanted to do was to try to take off the post-biblical glasses, mm-hmm, that most of us wear in approaching the text and try to see what the story says on its own terms.
All right, well, what does that expression, what does that world have to do with what you called a few moments ago, Carol Myers, the S words?
Those S words, I believe,
sin, sexuality,
submission, subordination.
Right.
I believe that those S words come from not from the Genesis 2 and 3 story. I'm not sure that they're there. We can come back to that in a minute if you want.
Those are later impositions.
It may interest you to know that after the third chapter or the fourth chapter, after the beginning of Genesis, Eve is never mentioned again in the Hebrew Bible. The Eve story, I believe, originates in an agricultural, in an agrarian setting of small villages and small households where families were very independent economically and socially, and therefore where the roles of male and female in the household had great social importance. The S words come from a period of much more urbanized life, where women were not so much part of the economic livelihood of the household, where she was much more relegated to the kinds of roles that we might think of in the modern early period.
In other words, men had seized political power, and this was a way for them to hold on to it.
Where women were privatized, they were seen as being bearers of children and housekeepers, homemakers. They weren't seen as having a critical role in the economic survival of society. I think that Eve is still, as well, we've said this since the very beginning of our discussion today, Eve is a powerful symbol, or else I probably wouldn't have investigated her and you wouldn't have asked me to come out here and talk about her.
Right.
She's a very powerful symbol. And it's fascinating to me to see how both people who want to uphold certain sexist tendencies in Western society, that is, males dominant over females, traditional aspects of modern American religion, for example. They'll cite the biblical story as a way of saying that males should continue to dominate females, that patriarchal values should be sustained.
That's the way God wanted it.
That's the way God wanted it. So if there's any move towards equality and gender egalitarianism in Western society, we have to take that the power of that story very seriously, because it still is a very authoritative text for secular as well as religious America.
What do you do, Carol Myers, to make sure that the evidence that you're using is consistent with that ancient world rather than our conceptions today?
There are various kinds of evidence that one can use. Perhaps the most important of all are ancient texts, and in this case we happen to have a text, the Bible, which is both the good news, and I mean that both literally and figuratively, and the bad news, because it too has a perspective, it too has a viewpoint that we have to look through. It is androcentric, that is, it is written by men, is probably directed towards men. It reflects the priestly and royal circles in Jerusalem, and so in some cases it's not even concerned at all with women. Women are tend to be ignored. Let me add that there are other resources for the task besides the biblical text itself, which is controversial as a as an eyewitness account to ancient Israelite society.
Archaeology.
You've taken number two right out of my mouth. Archaeology. I also am an archaeologist, a field archaeologist, and I've been involved in excavating in Israel for many years. And there are now excavations of small villages that do shed some light on the life circumstances of the time period about which I'm talking. It's fascinating to see how archaeology now is finally beginning to be able to give us this kind of information. Because in the 19th century and the 20th century, archaeologists went for the biggies. They went for cities and temples and urban areas and the places where the public domain, the male domain, was represented in artifacts. Now, finally, in the middle of the 20th and the this part of the 20th century, we're beginning to look at the less aesthetically interesting and important places, but the places where every man, every woman lived, small villages and towns and hamlets.
Well, that's consistent with much of what's going on in scholarship and political science, in history and in literature. Carol Myers, let me put you on the defensive. What do you say to somebody who is, I don't know if we'd want to use a word like fundamentalist or conservative. Labels are always a little misleading. What do you say to somebody who says, wait a minute, you're toying here with, you're questioning my beliefs. You are telling me that this inherited set of circumstances, the word, as I understand it, is really subject to a lot of scholarly tinkering. You're reconstructing as well as discovering Eve. How do you react to that?
I don't know if you'll let me go back now and substitute for the S words some I words.
All right, what
but
what
I think
might they
that
be?
Might that might indicate a little bit about what I have in mind. If you look at the Genesis story, you can ask yourself, who was the first human being to use speech, to utter speech? It's Eve, not Adam.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that might tell us something about a perspective about intelligence, that the symbol of intelligence, the first living being to utter words, is a female and not a male. If we can take away our expectations about Eve as being seductress and sinful and so on, we can see that she's intelligent. She's also, another I word, independent.
Mm-hmm.
She uses initiative. She engages the serpent in conversation. Now remember, the serpent at this point is not cursed. He's selected as being the most intelligent of all the animals.
Wiliest.
But wily has a kind of negative overtone.
That's
which
true.
I don't think the original Hebrew does.
Uh-huh.
Intelligent, smart, maybe. And who's the one that it's most natural for the serpent to engage in dialogue?
Well, he selects, as it were, his own.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Now, what happens to him later is another story.
Uh-huh.
But at the beginning, the dialogue between two intelligent beings is between the serpent and the female. Now, maybe this is giving us a message about the essence of female nature.
And she is, after all, the beginning of what the theologians call, what is it, the fortunate fall, felix culpa. We're glad that it happened, after all.
You shouldn't have used that word fall. You're going to open another waterfall of discussion for me. That word is not in the story.
It is not. It is not. What is the word?
There's no word for the story like that. That word fall, if I can give a short digression on this, comes
mm-hmm.
from Greek ideas. It's from Phaedrus, Plato's Phaedrus. It talks about heavenly beings flying around too close to the sun and their wings get damaged and they fall to
Icarus,
earth.
Icarus.
Well, it's kind of like that. It's not exactly that story. But then they grow up as humans.
Uh-huh.
And that idea of the fall is an imposition of Greek thought, of Greco-Roman thought on the Semitic world.
There's nothing there. Fascinating.
Go back and look at the story. That's one of the most common misconceptions about the story, that it's some sort of fall from grace.
Uh-huh.
I would rather call it an emergence to reality.
Well, that's consistent with the later Christianization of,
right.
of the story of what went on in Eden. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a conversation with Carol Myers of Duke University. Carol Myers is the author of Discovering Eve, Ancient Israelite Women in Context, published by Oxford University Press. She participated in a recent conference at the center on the making of the Hebrew Bible. Soundings continues now with a discussion featuring two other participants in the center's conference on biblical scholarship. Michael Fishbane is professor of Jewish religious history and social ethics at Brandeis University. Kyle McCarter is professor of Biblical and Ancient Near Eastern Studies at the Johns Hopkins University. Here is Kyle McCarter.
Well, I think a canon is a group of books or sacred writings which are accepted by some religious community as being authoritative. Often a canon is understood to be divinely inspired in addition to being authoritative, and in the case of the Judeo-Christian canon, that's true. That is, that both Jews and Christians have traditionally and historically regarded the sacred scriptures as sacred and as divinely inspired. It's important to remember, though, that one must speak of a canon with respect to a particular community. It's not only the literature that's involved in the question, it's the community.
Mm-hmm.
So that the Jewish community has a canon, the Protestant Christian community has a canon, the Catholic Christian community has a canon for its community.
Mm-hmm.
And those are not necessarily, even though the Judeo-Christian tradition is a continuous tradition, the canons for those communities are not historically identical.
They're not the same thing. Michael Fishbane? Yeah.
Yes, I'd like to take Kyle's point and add a different nuance to it, that it's very much true that the notion of canon, in a sense, is a phenomenon after ancient Israel. Canon, in a sense, is a phenomenon as a definable phenomenon, a phenomenon of Judaism in its varieties, Christianity in its varieties. And in many ways, The sharing between the religious communities is the acceptance of a certain boundary of so-called sacred texts, and where the communities differ is the way they reinterpret that and retrieve ancient Israel.
Let's see if we can nail the conversation down and be specific, Michael Fishbane, Kyle McCarter. When we talk about authorship in the Bible, are we talking about human beings? Are we talking about tablets? Are we talking about texts and scriptures? Are we talking about voices in one's head? How do you untangle those threads? Kyle McCarter?
Well, it's important to remember that in the part of the world and the time period that we're talking about, when we're talking about the growth of the Bible, authors tended to be anonymous. That is, the attribution of authorship to an individual by name is something that develops in the Hellenistic period, as far as we can see.
And that would put it how many years after the original composition?
Of course, it depends on which part of the Bible you're talking about, but we're talking about the period from the latter part of the 4th century before the turn of the era and later. So that and most of the biblical writings were composed before that, so most of them were anonymous. I say were because many of them later were attributed authorship. That is, the later community having to deal with a series of anonymous compositions tried to determine and believe they had determined where they came from. And this is why we have the five books of Moses attributed to Moses, the Psalms or some of them attributed to David, and so on. But in their, as far as we can see, in their original composition, these were anonymous works.
Well, what happened, Michael Fishbane? Did somebody take a vote and say, we're going to call this the Pentateuch and we're going to group all of these writings together? Were there literary, stylistic themes that looked familiar and similar enough to have something like that occur? Help me to understand specifically what went on.
Well, I think one important factor in the gathering of the material would have been the control of certain institutions, certain legal institutions, which had gathered material, and if they were in charge of the editing of that of the material, their particular perspectives may have gone into that. In the cultic material, we see in the Pentateuch the emphasis on the tradition that comes down through Aaron. It's quite different, for example, from some of the Pentateuch, some of the cultic traditions that were in existence in the post-exilic period with Ezekiel. So one of the factors may be those groups before or during the exile, which may have been able to institutionalize or present in a major segment of the material, their perspective.
There's a lot of confusion today about terms like biblical inerrancy. There are people in the population who look at the Bible and say, you know, it's like I went into JCPenney and I bought this thing complete, whole. It was just delivered there, you know, by God himself or herself. How is it that that we move through a tangle like that? I mean, is that the sort of thing that you biblical scholars worry about? Are you looking at it just purely in terms of its historical evolution, or do you worry about these questions of interpretation? Kyle?
Well, I think that in most of our work, we don't face those questions directly, but it's important to understand them. We've spoken already about the relationship in the question of canon between the literature and the community. That is, a canon makes no sense without the community to which it relates. For that community, that canon has a certain authority. Now, in fundamentalist traditions, and they're by no means confined to Christianity or Judaism, they're common in world religions in general, within fundamentalist traditions, then the authority of that canon tends to be absolutized. And the interpretation of what's said in the canon often is taken in a very straightforward and simple way. The contradiction between, and the difficulty that arises between, the way many biblical scholars approach the Bible, those who are interested in the history and the development of the Bible, the difference between them and the contradiction between them and a fundamentalist community lies in the degree of disagreement about how simple it is to understand what the literature says. That is, you may read something, it may seem to say something.
Yeah.
Scholars probably exasperate the community by insisting that it's a little more complicated than it seems, but we believe that most of these ideas had a long development that we can trace by studying the Bible, and it's a complex thing. It's perfectly understandable that a member of a faith community does not want to hear a lot of history. He wants simply to know what it means and live by it. And so there is a basic and fundamental difficulty there.
Michael Fishbane?
Yes, I think one of the things that might be helpfully distinguished, and here I'm referring to movements within classical Judaism, is that the notion of divine inspiration does not necessarily have to mean literal inerrancy. For example, the rabbis have a notion of what is called Torah min Shemayim, which in a sense means Torah which is divinely inspired. They understood the word heaven, Torah from heaven, really as Christians understand the kingdom of heaven. That was a name of God. It was sort of the Torah is somehow divinely inspired. And the words of the text would be accepted by the faith community, and no other words would be allowed into the closed canon of materials. However, the real cutting edge for the historical religious community is the stream of interpretation which is accepted as authoritative. And so the struggles between the different groups at any particular period is the struggle over the authority of what teacher has the right, is the best representative of interpreting that material. And so while the given text may be understood to be the given text having divine or traditional authority, the important factor for the community is the authority of the interpreters, who may give very radical and revisionary shape to that material, even though they say, this is the material that we start with, uh-huh. and we don't alter it because tradition has set it in a specific form, but the community, in its belief structure and in its practice over thousands of years, would have radically altered almost every single theological position or cultic position. Certainly that's the case in many parts of Judaism, but the tradition will say this is the text in its fixed form, mm-hmm. and it becomes the basis for the community's transformations.
Does it lead you, Kyle McCarter, Michael Fishbane, to a sort of happy futility? You know that no matter what you say, somebody's going to come along in 5 or 10 years or 5 or 10 months, and if not overturn, then modify significantly what you are saying about the formation of the Bible, and therefore its appeal to us as a cultural document. Kyle?
Well, actually, in the paper that I read today, I contradicted myself, something that I wrote 5 years ago. Uh-huh. And so it doesn't lead to futility. This is part and parcel of what we do. Trying to understand the set of questions that we're working with involves constant dialogue, changing, adjusting of positions. I think one thing that's very important to notice is that for all the disagreement that we have with each other, the disagreement doesn't break down along lines you might expect. There is no Jewish-Christian disagreement. That is, it doesn't break down that way. It doesn't break down between Orthodox, conservative, Reformed Jews or between Protestant and Catholic Christians. It's not a European versus American or an Israeli versus American scholarship. It's a whole series of different questions, and you find people lining up on both sides. On the literary question, on the question of whether the Bible ought to be read as literature without asking necessarily the historical questions, or whether we should try to plumb the historical depths, it's very interesting to see the people that line up on that side, because we have on the literary side people who are essentially religiously non-believers, humanists, mm-hmm. Who are insisting on reading it that way, and we have others who are probably fundamentalists reading the same way. It's interesting that the divisions then don't correspond to any that you might suspect, and I think that, rather than leading to futility, that's very reassuring, because it suggests there are real academic issues that are being discussed.
Michael Fishbane?
I would add, and I very much agree with what Kyle McCarter says, is that apart from our particular religious commitments to our own communities, we come here as humanists, and so the question the question of futility is not that we're trying to get at a pure truth and that if we feel that it's not going to work, we're frustrated.
Right.
I think we stand in relationship to this material with questions and humility and wonder, but what we're asking is, how does literature come to be formed? How does a literature shape a community? How do editors determine the shape of a community by determining the shape of its canon?
Sure.
How does something become authoritative, and how does that affect what is knowable, what's believable? So we're very much contemporary persons. Some of the agenda of the questions that we bring here are modern questions. History relives itself as the models of what questions emerge. So we're humanists in the sense that we're struggling to know, but we're trying to know for ourselves as much as we're trying to know for antiquity.
Michael Fishbane and Kyle McCarter participated in a recent conference at the National Humanities Center on the making of the Hebrew Bible. Michael Fishbane teaches at Brandeis University. Kyle McCarter is a professor at the Johns Hopkins University. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings is available on cassette. Ask for program number 428. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. That's program number 428. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, the first of two discussions about Victorian English Christmases. My guests will be Elliot Engel of North Carolina State University and Robert Patton of Rice University. Here's news of interest to high school teachers. In June and July of 1989, the National Humanities Center will sponsor seminars on two topics, literature and its audiences, and the concept of republicanism. These enrichment programs are for high school teachers of literature and history. For an application, write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. The deadline for applications is March 1st, 1989. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. The second week in December marks the anniversary of the discovery of Haiti by Christopher Columbus in 1492. In early December 1933, the country completed the repeal of the 18th Constitutional Amendment, which prohibited liquor in the United States. And the second week in December marks birthdays for Joel Chandler Harris, the creator of the Uncle Remus stories, and for the poets John Milton and Emily Dickinson. Harris was born in early December 1848, Milton during the second week of December 1608, and Dickinson in early December 1830. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Partial support for this edition of Soundings came from the Blumenthal Foundation of Charlotte, North Carolina. Major funding for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Eve and the Making of the Hebrew Bible, this week on Soundings. Listen for three scholars who recently participated in a conference at the National Humanities Center. Carol Myers of Duke University, Kyle McCarter of the Johns Hopkins University, and Michael Fishbane of Brandeis University provide the answers and insights. Eve and the Making of the Hebrew Bible, this week on Soundings.